This is an Ecodharma audio recording of a series of three talks from Buddhafield's Green Earth Awakening event in July 2014. The series is called Connect, Empower, Liberate, and it's delivered by me, Gujupati, a member of the Ecodharma Collective. For more about our work, check out www.ecodharma.com. Yeah, yesterday I was in here giving a talk, which was the first part of a series of three talks that I'm doing. The series is called Connect, Empower, Liberate. And, well, as you can probably guess, I'm sort of spending one day focusing on each of those three words. So yesterday I was talking about connection, and today I'm going to be focusing on empowerment. So yesterday I was pointing out something about three dimensions of connection, and the connection of people to themselves, the connection of people to other people, and the connection of people to nature. And I was saying that we really we need to attend to all three of those dimensions. And when we do attend to them all, then we find that we are in fact empowered by all of those dimensions of connection, and in different ways. And I was saying that actually that that empowerment is necessary to energize liberation. So the liberation, you know, what that can mean for us today, I'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow. But connection, so those three dimensions. So firstly, connecting with ourselves. When we connect with ourselves, we discover, you know, quite deep resources and qualities in ourselves. And you might call them sort of inner resources, inner qualities. But in a sense, they're not just personal resources, personal qualities. When we really connect with our depths, it's more as though we connect with a power that kind of works through us in some ways. It moves through us. And that has a kind of potential that's probably a lot greater than we tend to imagine. When we connect with others in community through social engagement, we discover the empowerment of collaboration, the magic that arises when we come together with others. So recognizing ourselves to be fundamentally social beings, we also discover within us the courage and the wisdom of hundreds of previous generations of our ancestors. So as individuals, we're formed in the social context. We're formed amidst social relations. We require community and the sort of the collective social dimension to really flourish as human beings. You know, the complexity of human consciousness, our language, our emotional intelligence, and our cultures, these all come from the fact of our social interaction. And the social dimension is integral to what we are. Connecting with nature, we open up to the support and the nourishment that comes from the ecological networks that we're part of, that we live amidst. Finding that we're not separate from the ecological web, we find that the power of life actually flows through us, having flowed through countless other species on a vast evolutionary journey, and it continues to run. That power of life continues to run through our veins. It fires in our synapses, coursing through our nervous system. And of course, communities and societies are all rooted in the ecological. The ecological, in a sense, is perhaps the most basic identity of the human animal. The ecological is our most fundamental economy. Ecology is the soil that our roots grow in, that we've been nourished by. And it remains our most basic source of nourishment for each of us and for our societies, despite how contemporary economics seeks to hide that or mask that fact. And so to really unleash the power of these three dimensions of connection, we do need to attend to all of them. recognizing that there's no final separation between those layers of connection at a personal, a social, and an ecological level. And attending to them all is far more empowering than attending to any one of them. John Wellwood coined the phrase spiritual bypassing. Some of you may be familiar with this idea. He's a psychotherapist. His work is influenced by Buddhist approaches. And during his career, he noticed that there can be a tendency in some approaches to spiritual practice to view the aim as a kind of negation of the ego. Often spiritual practitioners can set their aim on a goal of overcoming the self, going beyond the self. But Wellwood points out, a freedom from self-grasping can't be achieved on the basis of aversion towards the self or attempts to deny the self. In fact, to really approach the liberation that comes when we see the true nature of the self and learn not to hold on to it with attachment requires that first we develop a healthy sense of self, that we become deeply emotionally and psychologically integrated. That healthy self, that healthy sense of self is the only basis for going beyond the self. But of course, in the challenging conditions that we live in, the challenges of our times, we often find ourselves in a society where social violence, where abuse and exploitative relationships are incredibly pervasive. And many people are launched onto the spiritual path by the pain of the personal wounding from those relationships. You know, much of that wounding comes from dysfunctional relationships, both personal and social, and in turn, of course, leads to further dysfunctional relationships and further pain for ourselves and for others. So it's natural, isn't it, to want to get away from that experience. We can naturally want to get away from a self that suffers, and sometimes a spiritual practice that claims to enable us to overcome the self can seem to offer a solution. But all too often, sadly, the motivation can be a kind of aversion, a kind of desire to negate the self. So consequently, Wellwood has noticed that people engage in a spiritual practice in a way that seeks to leap to a kind of negation of the self, and without really taking the time to address the unintegrated aspects of their own psyches, without healing the wounds in their hearts and in their minds. And in this way, they can end up clinging to a view of no self simply to protect themselves from the pain of their own lack of integration. But it's a false and a superficial freedom. Its results are very limited and very shaky. Wellwood points towards the personal history of many spiritual teachers, particularly in the West, who appear to have a certain kind of spiritual charisma, you know, particular insights into this kind of no-self. But yet, there's often been witnessed sort of abusive, authoritarian and exploitative relationships between them and the people around them, their disciples and other people. And that suggests, says Wellwood, that there remain unresolved psychological conflicts that continue to operate within their psyche. So this bypassing of the process of psychological healing is what Wellwood calls spiritual bypassing. So I think it's quite interesting to extend this idea of spiritual bypassing beyond the personal. Instead of seeing bypassing as just pointing to a practice rooted in aversion towards the self, we can also extend it, I think, to notice an aversion-based turning away from other dimensions of the interconnected self. If we acknowledge our interconnected relationship with the social and the ecological, any practice that fails to stay in engaged relationship with those dimensions of the interconnected self can also be a kind of spiritual bypassing. Unless our spiritual practice simultaneously seeks to heal the wounds in our society and the ecosystem, as in, you know, as happens in attempts to bypass psychological dimensions of ourselves, our practice similarly will only lead to very limited results and a limited simulacrum of liberation. And at the same time, spiritually bypassing the healing of the social and the ecological, we will be cut off from the energy and the nourishment that comes from healthy connection with those dimensions of our lives. Consequently, our practice will only ever be superficially empowered. So the threefold path of ethics and meditation and wisdom is sequential. If we want insight to arise, we need to attend to meditation. And if we want meditation to have depth, we need to attend to ethics. And the same is true of these three terms that I'm using in these talks of connect, empower, and liberate. Liberation requires empowerment, but empowerment grows out of connection. Empowerment grows out of connection just as meditation grows out of ethics, as wisdom grows out of meditation. So connection, as I was saying yesterday, depends on the development of an intimate and caring sensibility. In a sense, we're always connected, just sometimes we happen not to be aware of it. But in addition to that awareness, healthy connection also depends on the structural aspects of our relationships, the infrastructure of society, our economic relations, our community processes. And we need supportive structures, relationships, communities and institutions, as well as a connecting personal sensibility to experience real empowerment. So the Eco Dharma Centre, I live in a community and I work as part of a team. And we're actually achieving quite a lot there. And all of that depends on the collaborative efforts between us. So no doubt a lot of people here will have had that sense of empowerment that comes from working well with others. When it goes well, we can feel the synergy and achieve so much more than any of us could achieve on our own. And not only do we experience the results of that, but also the potency that is collaboration. When we collaborate effectively with others, it can be as though our self is enriched. So getting it right is a bit tricky. Working well together requires us to attend to all sorts of things. So a simple framework that we use at Eco Dharma is to ensure that we attend to three aspects of collaboration, which are task, process, and relationships. So firstly, task. I mean, clearly, there needs to be clarity about tasks. You know, what are the aims? Do we share them? What are the steps necessary to achieve them? All of that is pretty basic. And we need processes that help define task, vision, strategy, objectives, and the specific actions that are required to realise them. I mean, that's what defines our purpose of coming together in setting, you know, specific, a shared vision together. But secondly, there's process. You know, we also need to give attention to process. How do we make decisions? How do we coordinate our efforts? How do we evaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it? So Eco Dharma, we put a lot of effort into our process. Different kinds of meeting structures, definitions of roles, careful shared decision making when it's needed. And they all ensure a sort of cooperative coordination. We also ensure a clear delegation of authority to individuals in different areas to balance cooperation with a sufficient autonomy so that people can actually get things done. So both these aspects, task and process, I see them really commonly attended to in a lot of the social action settings that I work in. You know, activist circles are often clear about what they're trying to achieve, at least in the short term. You know, they come together around specific action very often. And also often activists are very clear, or at least they tend a lot to process. Kind of sometimes even sort of super focused on process, because process is one of the places that issues of power and inclusion and diversity can be addressed. But all too often, what gets neglected is this third aspect of effectively collaborating, which is the aspect of relationships. So relationships, I mean, no matter how good our processes are, unless we attend to the quality of our relationships, we'll still find ourselves bogged down in power struggles and in conflicts, misunderstandings. Too often we think that just by tweaking our process, we can resolve those difficulties, but often they run at much deeper relational levels. And very often under the pressure of the moment, you know, when tasks get urgent, it's relationships that suffer. But it's very much a false economy, especially if we want longevity in our collaborating with people. Taking the time to attend to relationships really empowers our groups, and it builds trust and forgiveness and a kind of mutual understanding. And that trust and that understanding are necessary to underpin effective task and good process. So we need to attend to all of them. So because of the work I've done over recent years that we've all done at the Centre, EcoDharma, in our community, I currently feel really deeply empowered through collaboration with that team, with that community. But it's not only the community and the team who I feel that I'm collaborating with at the EcoDharma Centre. I mean, of course, there are also people who come and give their time, visitors, volunteers. There are lots of really important friends and supporters of the project, but that's not really what I'm talking about either. The project was set up in a remote valley in the Pyrenees. When I first arrived there, the buildings were in ruins and the land had been abandoned for generations. So I remember someone who was obviously impressed by what we were achieving, asking, so was there really nothing here when you first arrived? So I looked around at the forest, the limestone ridge, streams, circling vultures. And I said, well, actually, most of it was already here when I got here. So what we're doing, you know, as transient human animals, with our little plans, our little projects, it's only a small, a very momentary intrusion into a much, much bigger picture. And when I feel that humility, it opens me up to the support of the land, to the majesty of the limestone, to the steadfastness of the evergreen oaks, to the exquisiteness of the orchids, and to the elusiveness of the wild pigs. And I feel that both myself and the project are actually empowered by that each day. And there's more to it than that as well. I mean, we're rebuilding these houses, and so far we've rebuilt three houses, and it's hard work. You know, building with heavy limestone, it's hard, heavy work. Big pine trunks. I mean, right now, today, in fact, as we're here, the people back at home are rebuilding a new kitchen for our community. Last week I was putting the big pine trunks in for the beams for the first floor. So it's hard work, but as we do that work, we recognise just how indebted we are to the peasant farmers who lived there before us. You know, we know some of their families, we know their descendants. And, you know, these people, they gathered those stones and they placed them, and many of the walls, although the houses were in ruins, still substantial parts of them still standing. But even for the rocks that have tumbled down, you know, even the ruins there, still thankful for the fact that those people, they carried and transported those rocks to the place. It's hard work, you know, quarrying and transporting rock. So we owe them an enormous kind of debt. So our efforts, you know, I feel that they're kind of continuous with the efforts of those historical ancestors of the place. They dug out the springs, they planted trees that we're still eating from. You know, we still enjoy the fruits from many of the trees they planted. So in a sense, it's as though we collaborate with them through deep time. And I feel that when we forget our connectionness, our connectedness and our indebtedness to the past, we really disempower ourselves terribly. So as we build, as we're choosing these rocks and placing them one upon another, we're also working alongside these chemical and compressive processes that actually turn the lives of microscopic algae into limestone in the bottom of a shallow sea. Each stone we place has been on a long journey and through processes of transformation made deep in the earth and carried to the surface by really unimaginable forces, weathered and eroded and rolling down back towards where we can get them and use them. And in a sense, we're also collaborating with that too. And I definitely feel empowered by those forces. You know, even within our own bodies, you know, the rhythm of our breath and our heart as we kind of lift these primordial chunks of seabed and put them on the wall. You know, that rhythm is so much more than just the kind of conceited eye. You know, those rhythms trace back through those pathways of evolution that continue to beat in us each day. And that too, if we open up to that, that is also a very empowering dimension of our experience. So power actually gets quite a bad press, doesn't it? Perhaps rightly so. Often we appropriate power to ourselves and we use it abusively, which harms both ourselves and others. You know, they say power corrupts, but it doesn't need to. Really, it all depends on how we understand power, the training that we do in preparation for how we use it, and the social structures that we set up to keep us alive to its dynamics. For power not to corrupt, we need that initial training and connection. And Mahayana Buddhism emphasizes this, you know, insists that the spiritual path starts with bodhicitta. It states that the basic motivation for our development on the spiritual path needs to be the liberation of all beings. And that sense of solidarity with life is not an add-on to the Dharma. It has to be at its heart and right from the beginning. Otherwise, we can compound our self-referential tendencies and trap ourselves in isolation and arrogance. So in the same way, the Vajrayana also insists that, you know, if we're going to use the very powerful methods of transformation that are offered by the Vajrayana tradition, before we practice those methods, we first need to do a preparatory training, so much of which is about connecting. So we have to engage in the ordinary preliminaries of gratitude and appreciation for the preciousness of life. Bring an awareness to impermanence, the way that life is flow and flows through us. It involves a preliminary awareness of a recognition that ethical acts are the basic building blocks of our experience. And again, it emphasizes bodhicitta, motivation for the benefit of all beings. And after these, in the Vajrayana, there come the extraordinary preliminaries, in which we open ourselves up to really acknowledge that our spiritual development is not something we do alone. We leave ourselves in no doubt that our practice depends utterly on the support of our teachers and our spiritual friends, and on powers that that are deeper than the mere ego-grasping self. All of those trainings are necessary. They're required to ensure that we don't seek to appropriate to ourselves the deeply empowering methods of Vajrayana, which would cause us serious harm. So if we want such practices to empower liberation rather than ensnare us in self-serving habits, we need to be wary of taking shortcuts. Without an adequate ethical training, without paying enough attention to connection, power will tend to be used as power over in attempts to control others for our own benefit. But this is always at a cost, and ultimately it goes against ourself because we're not really separate from others. Power used for control alienates us from others, and as such it alienates us from ourselves. What we do in the world, we're also doing within ourselves to ourselves. So what I'm calling power over is very often what people think of when they hear the word power. But power is much more nuanced than that. Instead of power over, we can learn to become proficient in using power with, to empower ourselves and others simultaneously. So abusive power pervades our lives so much, often quite invisibly. And mostly, we're actually quite well socialized to accept it as normal. But inevitably, that abusive power wounds us and those around us. And so when we meet power in the world, it can touch into some deep patterns in ourselves. Sometimes we kick against power. Sometimes we collude with it. Sometimes we try to manipulate power. Sometimes we confront it. Sometimes we try to take it from others for ourselves. And very often, all these responses to power or authority come from quite unconscious struggles within ourselves. You know, power is complex, and our relationship with it can be complex too. But we can learn to work with power wisely. So if we're serious about working with others, it's really important to take a closer look at power and ask what it really is. It's a term with lots of connotations, but a little bit of a map can help us to kind of explore that. So recently, I've been developing some courses around effective collaboration that you know, provide people with skills and tools to work well with others, but also apply sort of Dharma-based understandings of the psychological and the emotional sort of dimensions of working effectively together. And I've been doing that with a colleague called Nick Osborne, who's actually from this part of the world. And during the course we did in April, Nick kind of presented this kind of map of understanding power in our groups. Okay, I thought it was quite elegant. So this isn't as you know, look, there's a lot of words on here, right? But it's quite an elegant kind of way of sort of analysing and looking at power in our groups. So this is a slightly adapted version from Nick's one. And it's based around kind of asking three questions. Right? Three questions. So the first one is, well, what is power? What do we mean by that? And a very simple definition, you know, working definition for this kind of stuff. So, well, power is the ability to influence things and people. One or the other or both. Okay? So, what is power? But in our groups, we can ask ourselves, you know, in our actions, what aims do we use power for? We can use power constructively and we can use it destructively. So constructively, power supports the purpose of the group. So there's no, you know, there's no sort of value judgment on that at this point, really. But destructively, we're using it for personal gain. Sometimes we're using it to sort of play out quite dysfunctional strategies in our lives as well. And basically, it's not supportive of the purpose of the group. Right? So that's very useful just to sort of see, is power being used constructively, because it can be, or is it being used destructively? You know, there are times where someone's influence within a group actually benefits the group. There are times when it doesn't. So then how do we use power? So we can use it in a controlling way, or we can use it collaboratively. These are both possibilities. So simple distinction, but an important one. And you know, a lot of what I'm talking about is how we make this shift from control to collaboration. But then we can also ask, so when we see power at work in our groups, in social settings, what types of power are at work? And there are many types of power, and kind of getting a sense of this sort of, these different types can be useful in our analysis. So there can be personal power. Right? It's something that an individual kind of carries kind of within them in a sense, right? So that can be sometimes charismatic. You know, people can have a certain kind of quality we call charismatic. Personal power can also come from expertise. We can have a knowledge base. We can be a specialist in something. We can have information others don't have. It might be because we've done a PhD. It might be just because we didn't tell them. A bit of information that's kind of behind the scenes or something, right? But there can be expertise. This is a form of personal power. There could be motivational personal power. You know, people who have that capacity to, you know, energize other people, right? And also another kind of personal power I think is worth mentioning is this idea of presence. which didn't be no motivational, particularly charismatic. But, you know, I think you see that often with people who have a good kind of mindfulness practice. It's just a, you know, they're just present, they're connected in themselves, and that has a certain power and quality about it. But power is not all about personal power. There's also power that comes from position. So position can enable us to influence others through being able to offer rewards. It can enable us to influence others through coercion. Positional power can also be bureaucratic. It's just by somebody's position within a system that kind of, you know, create the power is in the position, right? It can also be by relationship. You know, in a group, it might be that you have a lot of power in that group because of your friendship with so-and-so who has power in the group. Yeah? Nepotism is a form of power that comes from relationship, right? But also these last two ideas are quite interesting, that it can also be about our relationship to the mainstreams or the margins in our groups. Now, groups have mainstream cultures within them. And when we're part of that mainstream, we influence a certain kind of power. But it's also interesting that sometimes on the margins, we hold a different kind of power. So it's interesting. And then, of course, you know, other types of power come from structural socioeconomic dimensions of our relationships. So things like gender and race and class and property. There's others. But so that, you know, this sort of helps to say what kind of power we're talking about. You know, if someone seems to have power in a group, where does it come from? So there's a typology. The fifth question is about authority. Our relationship to authority is often as complicated as our relationship to power. They, you know, they're very much related. But we can ask, you know, is authority imposed? Or is authority something that's earned? And is authority distributed within your groups, or is it held onto? So it's a good question to ask. And when we ask all these questions, we also can start to kind of see some very simple basic patterns about power dynamics in our groups and organisations. So one pattern is a concentrated power. So it tends to look very often like a kind of pyramid. You know, an individual or small group at the top, and then a kind of chain of control and command, right, through an organisation. But with a lot of more horizontal organising in groups, we get kind of consensus type decision making processes. You can call this a pattern of shared power. You might sort of see it as an image, as a circle. Right? And there's a third pattern that I think is an interesting one, which is distributed or agile power, which is like networks, where power may not be shared by everybody, but it's distributed in differentiated ways within a system in an appropriate way. So, I mean, these are you know, that's a map. I find that really, really helpful to kind of get my head around, so what's going on here? And to open up conversations with people about this kind of stuff, you know, that we're working with. It's never enough to think that we've got this stuff sorted out in our groups or our relationships with people. You know, we need to have an ongoing conversation. But having those conversations does require courage. You know, it can be really uncomfortable. You know, power can be something that people are ashamed of, that they deny. But the more transparency we can bring to the power dynamics in our groups, the healthier they're going to be. So at EcoDharma, and also some of our colleagues who are working here this weekend, Catherine from Seeds of Change, we use a bunch of tools to help people to explore power in their own groups. And one really nice one, one challenging one, but really very, very simple to apply, is what we call chapati diagrams. So it comes out of popular education, first applied, I suspect, in India. And there it was done with bits of dough sort of banged out into different sized circles. We do it with bits of paper, circles of paper, different colours, different sized circles of coloured paper. And what you do is you get a group of you know, your group comes together, whoever it is you're working with, and each of you does a representation of how you see the balance of power in your group using these circles of colour paper. And very simply, you write a name on a piece of paper, and the bigger the circle, the more power you feel that that person exerts in the group or has within the group. Right? So you do that, then you share them, and you go, oh, you think I'm powerful, but I think you're more powerful than me, and you think she's really powerful, but she's, you know, and you start to, so why are they powerful? And it might be, well, their English isn't that good, and we do all our meetings in English. You know, they might be a very self-contained and sort of strong individual in a certain sense, but there's a sort of linguistic kind of, you know, structural factor that affects it. Might be because you guys, every time we have a meeting afterwards, you all go down the pub and make all the decisions for the next meeting when I'm not there. So you're, you know, so you start to sort of see these different dynamics of work, and it sort of just gets out on the table. So, but it's difficult stuff to deal with, you know, because there's a lot of sensitivity around our use of power in a group. So it's important to do it with care. A lot of sensitivity, to be building trust. And because our relationship with power can be often a bit messed up, we need to be really attentive to not using tools like these in service of our own less conscious struggles with power. You know, I mentioned Dana Meadows yesterday and her little kind of, you know, her little saying. I think it's true in this case. If you're going to use this stuff, it's really important to go for the good of the whole. If you're not going for the good of the whole, this, doing these kinds of analyses may well not help your groups. But if you are, they really will. So saying to be empowered as individuals is not just an individual thing. We also need communities and teams and other social relationships to be empowering. In a sense, it's only when we do take that responsibility to go for the good of the whole that we really benefit from the power of collaboration. Only when we begin to empower each other are we really empowering ourselves. Our development and the development of communities, they're all bound up together. And again, we do ourselves a disservice when we forget that. We need to work simultaneously with inner processes and the process of creating social settings, teams and groups and communities. And it's really important that those social settings reflect the values of collaboration, not the values of control. Those settings need to be empowering in themselves. So at EcoDharma, we draw inspiration from quite a few different people. And one of them is somebody called Miles Horton, and whose approach to popular education informed the work of the Highlander Education Centre that he founded in Appalachia in 1932. Really interesting to, I really, you know, recommend looking at some of their work. So Highlander played Miles Horton. The Highlander Education Centre. So Highlander played a really key role in the labour movement and in the American civil rights movement in the 1950s, training civil rights leaders like Rosa Parks before her historic role in the Montgomery bus boycott, and even people like Martin Luther King. And Horton's approach to education focused on empowering people in their own communities. Rather than feeding people information, it was about equipping individuals to learn from their experience, to bring out their own capabilities to benefit themselves and societies. Expressing his approach as an educator, he said, I don't know what to do. And if I did know what to do, I wouldn't tell you. Because if I had to tell you today, I'd have to tell you tomorrow. And then when I've gone, you'd have to get somebody else to tell you. So despite the purely didactic form of this talk, that is the kind of participatory approach to education that informs what we do at EcoDharma, you know, equipping people to learn from their own experience, not offering all the answers. And it's an education that's grounded in a deep care and a profound sense of human potential. So in conversation with Paulo Freire, who is another inspiring radical educator who wrote the book The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. In a conversation with him, Horton says, I think if I had to put a finger on what I consider good education, a good radical education, it wouldn't be anything about methods or techniques. It would be loving people first. So the trainings at Highlander, they started with a deep respect for the potential that individuals have, particularly to become agents for beneficial social change. And it was also grounded in the belief that social engagement is a necessary context for personal learning and development. They recognised that as intrinsically social beings, our own growth, our development and our maturation are deeply wrapped up with the development and maturation of our communities and of our society. And so consequently, Highlander tended to work mostly with people connected with organisations. They saw that it's through collective organising, through institutions, that society is transformed, and that the contexts are created that support the transformation of individuals. So in the same conversation with Freire, Horton went on to relate some observations that he made during a period at Highlander when the focus was placed more on self-development at the expense of the organisational and the social context. So Horton says that it was a period, quote, where people thought that consciousness was limited to their own conscious, something inside themselves. I guess some people thought it would start there and spread to society, but most of it kind of dead-ended there, as far as I could find out. If it starts there, it stays there. So I think there's something important to learn from that idea that if it starts on the inside, it stays on the inside. Drawing on the insights of systems thinking that I was talking about yesterday, we can see how the interconnections between self and society and the ecological exert reciprocal influences in each direction, between each systemic level. To understand the self, we need to attend to the social and the ecological. To understand society, we need to attend to individual consciousness and the bigger ecological context. And although we can talk about usefully about each of what's happening at each of those levels, it's important not to forget there's no strict separation between them, but a continuous flow of influence between them. If we get too caught up with our own consciousness, we run the risk of cutting ourselves off from who we are, from our social and ecological dimensions of identity. We end up with a kind of reduced, a shriveled self that's unable to really respond to the challenges or to be enriched by the nourishment that comes from those fundamental aspects of the interconnected self. So getting stuck on the inside is a developmental dead end. And that isn't just a personal matter, because it has social and ecological implications. The fact that society is highly conditioned by the agency of individuals means that if people get stuck on the inside, social development suffers. And the fact that human potency expresses itself through socio-economic forms that are currently having tremendous impacts on the environment also means that if people get stuck on the inside, the health of ecological systems suffers as well. And the well-being of the individual, society and ecology, of course, are all bound together. We require the outer context of engagement to support our learning, and society requires the inner work of individuals to dynamise social agency and well-being. And the resilience of ecosystems is damaged unless society honours our dependence on the ecological. So socially engaged Buddhists are often very aware of this kind of interplay between the personal and the social and the ecological. One of the things I found interesting is that of most of the people I know who are socially engaged Buddhists, most of them started with a political and ecological perspective on things. Very commonly, they were already had those perspectives before they came across the Dharma. It seems much less common for people to move from the Dharma to social and environmental engagement. I find that really curious. I mean, it's not, of course, there are exceptions, you know, it's not just like that. But just looking at my experience statistically, you know, it seems to bear out, Horton's idea kind of seems to bear out that if it starts on the inside, it stays on the inside. And that's one of the reasons why at Ekadharma Week, so we tend to attend to all three levels right from the outset of what we're doing. You know, if there's a danger that if we start on the inside, we're going to get stuck there. You know, if that's a developmental dead end, then we better take, you know, extra care to guard against it. All our efforts to heal ourselves need to sit within efforts to heal society and ecological damage. And none of that means we should neglect the inner work, right? Without the inner work, all our work in the world is going to be severely compromised. We need to learn how to cultivate courage and compassion and awareness from within ourselves to offer them as gifts to the world. And perhaps the most important method for that is, for this inner empowerment, is meditation. So meditation is deeply empowering. Through meditation, we can cultivate clear and integrated awareness and emotional capacity, the resilience and the robustness that's needed to keep meeting the world with tenderness and care again and again. One source of empowerment in meditation that seems often to be inadequately attended to is the power of dhyana. So dhyana is deep meditative concentration. That's the aim of samatha meditation practice. Sometimes it's also, you know, seen as synonymous with samadhi or tranquil abiding. But the term tranquil abiding doesn't really do justice to the source of creative energy and the joy that are integral to dhyana. You know, it's a state of deeply integrated, clear and energized mind. Sometimes people emphasize meditation as being calming, and other times they emphasize it, you know, the insight, the Vipassana dimension of meditation. I think it's really useful to acknowledge the energizing power of meditation that is dhyana. Because dhyana refreshes the mind, it releases brightness and clarity. So unlike everyday consciousness. And if we really want to offer our gifts to the world, giving sufficient attention to cultivating that in our experience on a regular basis is really priceless. I think dhyana can often be regarded as a bit of a lofty achievement by meditators, but it needn't be very distant. It's simply the natural condition of the mind when we set up the right conditions. Really, it's just a matter of attending to those conditions. And when we do, dhyana arises naturally, like warm air rises on a south-facing limestone rock face. So as I mentioned, the principal conditions to support deeper meditative experience, the principal condition is to attend to our ethics, you know, to really feel our connection with the world with an intimate care. So that has to come first if we want dhyana to become part of our daily experience, to become something that becomes more settled. We also need to be clear that meditation is continuous with our daily life. And accessing dhyana regularly is really a matter of choice about what we do with our lives and how we live it day to day. If we attend to those simple things, it can become a regular part of our lives. But as well as that, as well as those kinds of preparations, there's also skill involved. So we need to train in the skill of meditating. You know, meditation is something we need to approach like an art, like learning a new musical instrument. Not so much as a chore, you know. So as an art, it requires a careful kind of perfection. And it needs a dedication to acquiring those skills. So I think, you know, today in the Buddhist world, there's a lot of very, very good meditation teaching going on. Because I'm talking about empowerment, and because I think meditation is, you know, if we're going to engage in the world, if we're going to, you know, be beneficial in our groups and our communities, in our relationships and society, meditation is a really key tool. So I'm actually going to share a little bit about a really beautiful set of similes that have been passed down from the meditation instructions of the Vajrayana Mahasiddhi Saraha. So there are six similes that he suggests that we use to help the mind to settle towards deep concentrative abiding. So the six are, and then I'll kind of, you know, unpack them a little bit. The first is settling the mind like the sun unobscured by clouds. The second is settling like a Garuda circling in the sky. Settling like a Garuda circling in the sky. Settling like the depth of the ocean, settling like a small child staring at the wall paintings in a temple, settling like the trail of a bird flying in the sky, and settling like fine, good quality cotton thread. So what's he getting at with these similes? Well, briefly, settling the mind like the sun unobscured by clouds. It means that we need to look for a mind that's unmixed by conceptual thoughts or by mental thinking. You know, as conceptual thought reduces in our meditation practice, as the mind becomes more refined, as the thinking becomes more slight, the danger is that the mind can sink towards dullness. And instead, we need to be looking out for the natural brightness of the mind, to be attentive to that. So in relationship to dhyana, mindfulness of breathing, or metta practice, they're access practices. And they're not ends in themselves. You know, of course, paradoxically, for them to work, we need to treat them as ends in themselves. But when we do that, and when they do sort of, you know, when we deepen into those, we can begin to notice the brightness and the clear, energized quality of the mind. And as we start to notice that, as that arises, we let go of the breathing, we let go of metta, and we take that brightness of mind as the object. That's what we settle into. So this is the settling of the mind like the sun unobscured by clouds. Settling like a Garuda circling in the sky. Well, a Garuda is a large, mythic, flying, mythological beast in ancient India. I haven't seen many of them around. I'm not quite sure how they fly. But I do see a lot of vultures, lots of vultures where I live. And I think we can learn the same thing as Saraha's getting out using the Garuda by observing the flight of vultures riding on the thermals. So we learn a lot from them. You know, if you watch them, you see, as they soar, they kind of use there's tiniest inflection of change, you know, tiniest movement of their wings. You know, tiny movement here, and, you know, they change direction dramatically. In meditation, it's much the same. The tiniest shift in attitude can make very big changes. And actually, we need to learn to work in meditation with making these very subtle, very slight adjustments and adaptations to our approach. And when we do that, we kind of steer into the thermals of meditation, which kind of lift us quite naturally. And it's like the effort, what lifts us isn't our flapping our wings, it's just the subtle adjustments that kind of steer into those currents that will uplift us. So settling like a Garuda circling in the sky. Settling like this still depth of the ocean. It suggests that single-pointedness, you know, the concentrating aspect of meditation, it's not a superficial focusing. It's more like a sort of a deep settling. It's not, you know, in meditation that we shouldn't really be focusing a narrow part of our mind on the object of meditation. We need to bring an approach that's bringing our whole body, the whole psycho-physical entity that we are, the entirety of that, to settle into the kind of the presence with the object of the meditation practice. So single-pointedness in this sense is more of a fullness of presence rather than a narrow focusing. So this is settling like the still depth of the ocean. Settling like a small child staring at the wall paintings in a temple. It's a good one, isn't it? So Sarah is kind of saying, look, you know, when a child walks into the monastery complex, there's these big frescoes on the walls, right? What they do at first is they see the whole thing, all the colours, you know, this big kind of... And then it's only after a while that they start to pay attention to the details. The same in meditation. We're sort of deepening in concentration in meditation. We start with quite a generalised, broad sense of the object. And then gradually, we allow the details of that to come out more and more vividly. We're able to really give attention to the fine detail of that experience. We start broadly, like the child looking at the paintings on the wall of a temple. Settling like the trail of a bird flying in the sky. So Sarah is saying, we should allow distracting thoughts to arise, that arise, to pass through our mind just as a bird leaves no trace or no tracks in the sky. You know, distracting thoughts do arise. And of course, those distracting thoughts can then become, they can leave this track by us kind of getting into them, you know, and perpetuating them more, proliferating them. But also just in our response to them, by kind of like getting unsettled, is like, why am I getting distracted? Why is this not necessary? You know, actually, once the thought's gone, it's gone. And that clarity of mind remains. And so we settle back with that clarity of mind, keeping on coming back to that background foundational clarity that's there, that the mind, that the thoughts just pass through. So settling like the trail of a bird flying in the sky. And then lastly, settling like fine, good quality cotton thread. So cotton thread is soft and fine but strong. And our mind in meditation, it should be comfortable and relaxed, but strongly tied to the object. So as we practice, we need to keep looking for a soft, pliable, fine quality in the mind. And at the same time, we need to hold this subtle and gentle quality of the mind tied strongly to the object. So there's something that feels paradoxical about it, but as a simile, kind of just dropping it into your practice and saying, what could that mean to the attitude that I'm bringing to this? What could that mean to the approach that I'm taking here? So I think it's a great, really lovely set of similes. I find it really, really kind of helpful in my practice. So, yeah, we talk about balancing outer activity with inner sustenance. And personally, I think that, you know, to sustain the daily challenges of working with other people, of engaging in the world, that the empowerment of the dhyana is really vital. You know, I think it's really vital, the energy that comes from that, the clarity that comes from that. And I think it's worth sacrificing a lot of other things to make sure that's in place. You know, I do, you know, I'm very engaged in quite a lot of stuff. But, you know, this year, the start of the year, I still carved out 2 whole months to be on retreat. You know, a month with the community in silent retreat and a month in a cave on solitary retreat. And doing that, it's like, since then I've been really busy and everything's been so much more effective. You know, just because we want to be effective doesn't mean we shouldn't be attending to that stuff. We will be more effective if we really do it justice. So as well as dhyana, another important source of empowerment that comes from meditation comes out of the practice of the Brahma Viharas. This is the last thing I'm going to really talk about. So yesterday I was talking about kindness, about metta. So metta, of course, sits within a meditation system known as the Brahma Viharas, or the Four Immeasurables. As well as metta, there are these three other qualities, the quality of karuna, mudita, and upekkha. And just practicing metta isn't enough. Although our training in the Four Immeasurables starts with metta, or loving-kindness, fostering a caring, intimate connection with the pulse of life as we see it in ourselves and in others. That in itself just isn't quite enough to really empower our action in the world. There's this, you know, when we try to understand what karuna and mudita are, one of the kind of the classic ways of seeing that is just saying, well, when we turn that open-heartedness of metta towards suffering, compassion naturally arises, and that's karuna. When we turn the open-heartedness of metta towards the joy and the well-being of others, mudita arises. That means, you know, sympathetic, appreciative joy for the joy of others. Right? So that's mudita, and that's karuna. I won't say anything about equanimity just now. So mudita and karuna, they augment metta in a very important way. Metta, as I said, it's the starting place of gently opening the heart, but it's compassion, it's karuna, the turning of this open-heartedness consciously towards suffering in the world, that protects metta from degrading, degenerating into sentimentality. It's the karuna that stirs us into action. It's the karuna that gets metta off the cushion and into the world. The appreciative joy of mudita keeps us alive to the joy and the fulfillment in the world. It provides essential nourishment that feed our efforts to alleviate suffering. Otherwise we can become so easily overwhelmed. If we only turn towards suffering, we may lack the nourishment to really keep going. But by consciously, within our meditation practice, consciously turning our awareness towards the flourishing, the creativity and the well-being in the world, which in fact is all around us, we uplift our mind. And when we turn it not only towards the everyday joy in the world, but specifically towards the deep joy that arises through people practicing the path of the Dharma, we can, and we really allow ourselves to feel a joyful appreciation of that, we can find ourselves deeply energized in our mind and our body. So both karuna and mudita, they add power to metta, and the necessary complements to the practice of metta. And you know, personally, I think that giving space to all of those each day is a really, really valuable thing to do. Just somewhere at the beginning of a meditation practice, you know, even if it's just 10 minutes of the practice, but attending to all of them. So the fourth of the four immeasurables is equanimity. It's what finally brings the other three really to fruition. And while equanimity grows out of the other three, it also requires to be kind of perfumed by the insights of liberation. And although it kind of leaves it hanging, given that liberate is the theme for tomorrow, I'll probably leave it there until then, because it is a series after all.